ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Representatives of 12 Caribbean governments are in London to try to persuade the British that they have an old obligation to address the damage done in the last few weeks by Hurricane Melissa. Why? Because West Indian slave money financed the Industrial Revolution, which is to blame in the end for the climate catastrophes like the hurricanes that tear across the Caribbean. We'll cross to London later. Fascinating work is being done on foxes in Australia, how they've spread, where they thrive, and what can be done after all this time to protect the species they are driving to extinction. But first, and urgently, to Bruce Shapiro, standing by in Connecticut, to take us into the latest episode of the Epstein saga. Bruce, where are we?
We are in the space of complete reversal by President Trump, who only, of course, days ago was fighting tooth and nail to prevent the release of whatever files the government still holds on Jeffrey Epstein and his victims, the Epstein files. He now faced a complete revolt by the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives, which joined with Democrats. Congress voted with only one opposing vote to request that the files on the Jeffrey Epstein investigations all be released. And now it's going to the Senate. The Senate has approved it as well. The Republicans joining with Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader.
Unanimously.
We saw today on the steps of the Capitol an extraordinary press conference by women who had been trafficked, abused, and assaulted by Jeffrey Epstein over the course of his long career prior to his death. They spoke with great eloquence about their long and patient search for justice, and they were joined by a bipartisan group of representatives who have been campaigning seemingly uphill for months and suddenly saw the tide turn. Of course, this doesn't mean the files will actually be released.
Yeah, I want to dig down into that because, yeah, you know, where are the files? Are they safe?
There's lots of files, right? I mean, there's the files that the government has. There's the files perhaps that the state still has. We've seen emails over the last week that the estate of Jeffrey Epstein had supplied to Congress, those emails that not only touched on President Trump and the, you know, quoted Epstein as saying that Trump knew about the girls, which it's hard to evaluate the factuality of that, but they've already had the, you know, collateral effect those email has of have of not only affecting Donald Trump, but one of his ideological opponents, Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard, former Treasury Secretary, who was one of the many elite power players caught up in Jeffrey Epstein's seductive power games. And I think that this goes to the heart of why the Epstein case has been so sticky for Donald Trump, why he hasn't been able to escape it, right? On the one hand, you know, you could just say, well, he tried to ride the conspiracy dragon and he finally couldn't control it. But there's more to it than that. When we saw those women stand in front of the Capitol today, what we were reminded of was how the incredible power that victims of crime have sometimes had in American politics, undoing presidents on the right and on the left. And also that this episode speaks, I think, to the culture of impunity at the highest levels of power in America, whether it is Donald Trump, whether it is the people who brought us to torture and war in Iraq, whether it is Silicon Valley oligarchs, there is widespread perception of a culture of impunity. And this case suddenly has become a surrogate for all of that. And that has turned out to be something that Donald Trump, despite his desire to not have the public remember that he's a convicted sexual offender himself, that's something that turned out to be overwhelming that he couldn't even control in his own caucus.
Is one of these, one of the aspects of this, that he has led this deeply paradoxical political existence, getting votes by condemning elites, by convincing people in America that he understands how they have been burnt by the elites, while gathering an elite force around him and legislating for their benefit the entire time? And this is, in a way, the proof of the things that Trump has been saying about the elites in this bizarre upside-down politics.
Well, indeed, and that is what is fracturing the MAGA base, right? That is why we saw three of the most vociferously MAGA of MAGA women in Congress: Nancy Mace from South Carolina, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia. Why these women who are on the sort of populist, anti-elite end of MAGA finally felt discarded and ignored by the White House on this issue. And of course, in the case of Marjorie Taylor Greene, a spectacularly loyal Trump conspiracy mongering ally, the president did what he does so often to women. He dismissed her with a lot of derogatory language about her mental health. And that's why we're seeing the MAGA base split. We should say, however, that, you know, this case is just, it does touch the Democratic base as well, because after all, you have your Silicon Valley billionaires, you have your Larry Summers, you have Clinton and others who were in these circles of elite communication around this billionaire sexual predator, and nobody comes out especially well.
Let's put our hard journalistic hats on here and evaluate what we know already about Trump from those Epstein files that have been released. Would you agree there's a lot of smoke there, but we really haven't seen much fire?
No, we have not. You know, we have to say that there has not been a living witness who has come forward to say that they were abused by Trump in Jeffrey Epstein's company. Virginia Giuffre, the late Virginia Giuffre, is quoted and is cited in one of these emails as having spent a lot of time with Trump, but she was on record saying that Trump never did anything improper.
Yeah.
You know, it's not clear whether there actually is going to be anything that directly implicates the president. You know, it reminds me in a certain way of the, you know, the Steele dossier in the first term. We may not know what really happened, but I think the power of the Epstein case is because, for all of these complicated reasons, but at bottom, what we do know is that Trump was part of this community, had a close relationship with Epstein, ultimately had a rupture with him. But we also know that Epstein's attitudes towards women and his uses and abuses of women were mirrored in Trump's behavior and attitudes. Will the Epstein case, in an enduring way, divide some parts of his base and outrage the American public sufficiently to keep to damage him in the long run? We'll need to see. Mm. But it certainly led to this unusual spectacle of the president, in the face of a defeat in his own caucus, beating a hasty retreat and turning his own position around. I have to say, in some ways, as important as this is, and especially coming after a couple of weeks in which the president's fortunes really do seem to have taken a downturn, beginning with the elections only 2 weeks ago in New York and Virginia.
Which were shattering for him, surely.
Which were very damaging for the Republican Party and for Trump. Now this, in some ways, even more important, which the Epstein saga has distracted from and which Trump is happy for the distraction from, have been a series of profound and stinging defeats over the last 7 days in federal courts around the country.
Now, Bruce, can we pause for 1 second for me to say that this is ABC Radio National. This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. You're Bruce Shapiro in the United States, telling us the latest in this extraordinary dramas of American politics. Bruce, continue. The courts have been looking at his actions once more and finding them wanting.
Well, and in particular, a whole raft of policies connected to immigration enforcement and related issues. But even more important than that, the investigation, the indictment of former FBI Director James Comey, a magistrate judge, a federal judge in Virginia, has voiced a concern that there may have been gross misconduct by the Justice Department. And misconduct is not something the Justice Department frequently gets charged with by a federal judge. That is quite consequential. We've never heard language like that. In the same week, federal judges in Memphis, in Chicago, and elsewhere have further blocked the deployment of the National Guard and other elements of the immigration enforcement, the thuggish immigration enforcement theater that we saw playing out this week in the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, over the course of the last month in Chicago with such extraordinary violence. The courts all around the country are taking notice and smacking this president back. Whether he ultimately wins, we don't know, but it has been a week of extraordinary defeats for his agenda in one court after another.
But Bruce, the pattern over this year has been defeats in the lower courts and rescue in the higher courts. Is there anything to suggest that that pattern will not continue?
Well, last week at the U.S. Supreme Court, there was a hearing over the single most important feature of Trump's economic policy, his tariffs, the infamous tariffs. And there, a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court, including conservative justices appointed by Trump himself, seemed deeply skeptical of the president's tariff policy. They pointed out in their questions, this isn't the ruling, this is just a hearing, but their questions indicated that the justices, even Trump-appointed justices, understand well that Congress has the taxing power under the U.S. Constitution, that the various laws allowing the president to act in emergencies probably don't apply in all of the circumstances in which the president has reached into that emergency grab bag to impose tariffs on the world economy. This is lining up to be an epic defeat for the central plank of Trump economic policy. So on that one, at least, a Supreme Court that has been extraordinarily deferential to executive power to this point, does seem ready to break with the president.
Bruce, you know that pattern. We've seen it again and again and again, where authoritarian leaders begin to be defeated at home. They like to fight abroad. What is that aircraft carrier doing off the coast of Venezuela?
Well, again, Trump, the master of distraction, understands that you got to keep the story moving. And we are seeing a steady escalation of violence in the Caribbean. We now have seen more than a dozen boats, significant numbers of people killed in drone strikes, which again, even Republicans in Congress are beginning to say represent an extra legal use of power by the president.
He has no authority to do it.
He has no authority. Well, not only does he have no authority to do it, but there's been no evidence presented that these boats were actually up to anything, right? In one case, there's at least one case of a Colombian fisherman whose family is suing in American courts because he was killed in one of these drone strikes. Of course, what it's all ramping up for is the possibility of military confrontation with Venezuela, with President Maduro, who, you know, in turn stood before the microphone and in a almost Trump-worthy moment, stood there singing John Lennon's Imagine in response to Trump's latest threats, right?
But
here again, there's a deep threat of fracturing the MAGA base. I mean, you do have to remember that MAGA is an isolationist movement.
They don't like foreign wars.
Yeah. And the, you know, projection of power and of nation building and all of that in Iraq was one of the betrayals and sources of disillusionment which fed the what became the MAGA movement. So this is a risky strategy for Trump too. My own guess is that Trump himself will not have an appetite for a big war in Venezuela, that this is about saber-rattling theater. But we're entering unpredictable territory with a president who does seem to be suddenly flailing in several important areas, and we don't know how Trump is going to react.
Bruce, thank you once again for...
As always.
I'm going to say it, making sense of the United States of America and its politics. Bruce Shapiro is, of course, contributing editor at The Nation and executive director at the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Coming up, fixing carnage in the Caribbean. Hurricane Melissa hit Jamaica in October with devastating force, a Category 5 storm with winds of 300 kilometres an hour that tore the island apart. The repair bill is still being added up, but it looks as though it's going to exceed $6 billion US, and the work will take years. Aid is arriving. The Brits have promised £7.5 million, but Caribbean officials have gone to London to argue that their islands are owed far, far more from the United Kingdom. It is a mighty argument that the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, that's ultimately to blame for global warming, was fueled by the fortunes of Caribbean slave owners. Climate justice cannot be separated from reparatory justice, argues Jamaican economist Mariama Williams. The same system that enriched the North created today's vulnerabilities. Natricia Duncan is the Guardian's Caribbean correspondent. She's usually in Jamaica, but she's in London at the moment to cover that meeting and joins me now. Natricia, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
What sort of state is Jamaica in at the moment? What's it look like?
It's a very challenging situation. I visited some of the worst affected areas like a day or two after the hurricane. I actually couldn't get to places like Black River, you know, which was considered ground zero, because the devastation is just mind-boggling. That's the best way I can describe it. Getting there I said I attempted on the day, which was the Wednesday after the hurricane. Impassable roads because of landslides, because of severe flooding. Second day, which was a Thursday, I did manage to get there, but it felt apocalyptic. You know, you had to sort of drive through waters that unfortunately damaged the vehicle that we were in. There were vehicles stalling. It was total chaos, people desperate to try and reach their families. And once you got there, it's something that was quite emotional to see. You had people with children trying to set up shelter at bus stops. There was even some looting. It was just totally flattened. Buildings that were there for hundreds of years. There was a church there, for example, and it was just completely destroyed. It looked like a bomb had gone off. When I just arrived, I tried to speak with this lady, and she said, you know, there's just been a death, another death, and she was about to go to the police station. But it was, the best way I could describe what I saw that day was apocalyptic. I mean, since then, it has been a bit of a grim assessment. You know, 29.5 billion in terms of losses from the agricultural sector, which, as you could imagine, is critically important. 70,000 farmers affected. As you said, that's $6.7 billion. And obviously there was some insurance, but that's only 150 million. And so, you know, we're talking 360,000 people. When I last checked it, this was last week. I don't know if that has been updated in terms of the number of people affected. 60% of tourist assets affected, which, you know, Jamaica economy is so based on tourism. So this is, for all intents and purposes, it is a really serious crisis.
I take it that the principal way Jamaica earns cash from the rest of the world is actually through tourism. What's happened to hotels and tourists?
Well, this is what I was saying. Last I checked, the report said that 60% of the tourist assets were affected. Obviously, it hit Montego Bay. And Montego Bay is one of the areas that has lots of hotels, all-inclusives, and really nice hotels there. And, you know, those hotels suffered some damage. I know that there were tourists there. Actually, I had a cousin who was in a hotel in Montego Bay when it hit, and they, you know, they obviously did their best to look after people hurt. So it's going to take a while. I have last seen that the tourism minister was saying that by December sometime, I think it might have been mid-December, that, you know, the tourism industry will be up and running again and ready to welcome tourists. But, I mean, you know, this was a historic event, you know.
Yes. And you've had hurricanes before, but this is the biggest that's ever hit Jamaica?
Yes, according to the records I've seen, it is the biggest that has ever hit Jamaica. I mean, if you look at other hurricanes like Beryl, for example, and Gilbert, they were also quite significant. And I think what I have heard from a lot of Jamaicans was that Gilbert had more of a sort of widespread impact in the terms of that it hit more parts of the country. But when I spoke to people on the ground in the most affected places, and we were talking to people in their 60s, in their 80s, and all of them were saying to me, I have lived in Jamaica all my life, and I have never, ever seen anything like this.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Natricia Duncan, who is the Caribbean correspondent for The Guardian, about Melissa and about the arguments that are being put in London and at COP30, that something particular is owed to the nations of the Caribbean. Now, Tricia, take us through this argument step by step. First, the point that slave money financed the Industrial Revolution.
Yes, so this is actually an emerging argument, which it's quite interesting to see. And it's something that is now developing. Obviously, CARICOM reparations is something that has been a movement that has been going since around 2013. And it started with this recognition that Caribbean nations were impacted and continue to be impacted by enslavement, by colonialism, that the people who lived there were predominantly people of African descent. They continue to feel the impacts, the effects of something that European nations used to build their own economies and their countries. And one of the arguments is that when most of the Caribbean nations who are in a group called called CARICOM, Caribbean Community, there are 15 members, most of them are English speaking. Of course, you have Haiti, which is French speaking and which was owned by France. And you have some other members that were owned by Dutch colonies. But, what they all have in common is that they were former colonies. And one of the arguments is that when they did get their independence, starting from the 1960s and upward, they were left with a colonial mess. Someone said yesterday that a mess in terms of a large portion of the population were illiterate at that time. There were not enough schools or hospitals. There was nothing really to start a country and to start developing in a way that is sustainable and in a way that will catch up with the rest of the world. And so, first of all, there was a crime committed as well. And I think that is an important point in this. And so where there is a crime, there needs to be justice. And those are some of the arguments that I've been hearing from the Reparations Commission when they're saying that, these are the important things. What has happened in the past is that the CARICOM Reparations Commission has outlined 10 points. They call it a 10-point plan, which basically says what reparations should look like. So, for example, it should include an apology from the European nations who colonized these countries and a full official apology. It should include some form of financial reparations, such as debt cancellation. There should be some form of sort of looking at some of the impact, psychological health impacts that slavery and colonialism has had on these populations. So that was sort of the argument. But recently, there's now been a rising voice linking, climate justice and slavery reparations. And as you rightly said, the argument is that slavery and the Industrial Revolution was basically made possible by resources provided by colonialism and enslavement. And so that is another element of the conversation that is now sort of being discussed. And currently, that 10-point plan I mentioned, CARICOM is looking at revising that, although they haven't as yet shared what the new plan or what the new or if the change is the updated 10-point plan.
Natricia, explain to us what CARICOM is.
So CARICOM is a group of Caribbean nations, and so it's 15 nations and I believe 7 associate members. And so basically it's an intergovernmental group and they represent the interests of these 15 countries. They act together on issues like climate change and, for example, reparations. They've been looking at different issues such as freedom of movement between them. So this is it's essentially an intergovernmental. So it's a mini Commonwealth in that sense.
Right.
But it's a very tight-knit group.
And this is a new argument that they're putting, that there is a responsibility from Britain and other northern countries for the damage done to the climate and tracking that damage down in some way to the exploitation of slaves and the exploitation of the West Indies. But how is that argument being received in Britain? Is it being taken seriously?
So I want to make it clear that this argument, it's not currently, it didn't emerge from the CARICOM Reparations Committee in that way. It is part of the global movement, but I just want to make that distinction.
Yes.
Although it has been raised, this argument, like at COP at the moment, there are a group of humanitarians, environmentalists who have been pushing this argument. And so this is almost coming from the ground up. So, you know, there are two things I think that we need to be aware of. You have the climate justice argument that the Caribbean has been pushing for decades now. And, you know, that is something that, again, CARICOM is very passionate about. They've been, you know, sort of at COP and in all the international arenas, they have been saying that they have been unjustly affected. They're bearing the brunt of climate change that they did not cause or they contributed very little to. And so that is a very long and ongoing argument. I think what is now happening, and as I mentioned, this is a new emerging idea of putting both that climate justice, that pursuit of climate justice and the pursuit of reparatory justice together. And that is something that lots of different groups are pushing and that CARICOM, the CARICOM Reparations Committee, is now looking at.
So it's being put simultaneously, really, at COP in Brazil and by this delegation in London. Who is the delegation in London talking to?
So the delegation in London, they're talking to UK parliamentarians, they're talking to academics, they're talking to civil society. And what they're aiming to do is to sort of have a sort of public education outreach. And this is because lots of people, they think in the UK, are still not aware of Britain's role in slavery and in colonialism, and that the impact, the lasting impact that it has had on communities in the Caribbean. And I think that is one of the things that they have seen often from what they consider to be misleading reports in the UK press and in comments, for example, on social media and in other forums where people you know, are saying, oh, there's one misconception that they were really keen to address, which is that, you know, this reparations commission is coming to the UK to, you know, take trillions of dollars and break the treasury. And this is one of the things that they really address, that it is not about coming to the UK and extracting money from the UK. It is about looking at something that this colonial mess we mentioned and looking at how they could together repair this and you know, how could they have a mutually beneficial solution to what has happened? And this is what they've called for is a summit where these Caribbean leaders and the UK can sit down and work out what that should look like, or, you know, what remedies. But yeah, they were very clear that this notion that they're coming to just leave with a boatload of cash, that was not the aim. It is about you know, a restorative justice program that is mutually beneficial.
And how do you rate the chances of such a, you know, a high powered meeting of minds taking place?
Well, according to, I could tell you, according to the CARICOM Reparations Commission, they made a point yesterday that this is something that, you know, they believe in, that they're passionate about, and that they believe could be made possible. I mean, we saw last year when the Caribbean nations at the Commonwealth Leaders Summit, this was in Samoa in 2024, when Caribbean leaders wanted to put slavery reparations on the agenda of CHOGM, the CHOGM, which is the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, there was a big pushback from Britain, and they were saying, we want to be forward-looking, we want to focus on modern-day challenges. We do acknowledge that slavery was abhorrent, but we need to be looking forward. However, at the end of that meeting, you know, there was an agreement in the communique, in the leader's statement, to start you know, having a meaningful look at this and address this. So what I can see personally is that I can see that this group is having an impact on these Caribbean. Yeah, I mean, they represent the Caribbean governments. And, you know, you could see that the whole movement is beginning to grow. I mean, I find it, I've been covering reparations and I've known about reparations for a while. And I am just, you know, struck by how this is now becoming a global movement and how now it's at COP. And, you know, you have all of these groups and organizations at COP, including the UN Forum for African People, who are saying this is something that we need to look at. So to me, that this is growing into a very powerful movement.
Natricia, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Natricia Duncan, Caribbean correspondent for The Guardian. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, how foxes spread, thrive, and may be contained. Here at Late Night Live over the last year, we've been examining, predator by predator, the carnage caused by animals Europeans brought to Australia. It's a strange fascination. Rabbits and deer are already accounted for, cats are still to come, but now foxes. They drive extinctions by killing about 300 million native animals a year. Joining me from West Australia is Dr. Sean Tomlinson from the School of Molecular and Life Sciences at Curtin University, an expert on the fox in Australia. Sean, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here.
They're scary little bastards, aren't they? I remember walking through London a few years ago on a hot summer night, and suddenly there was a fox in front of me. It's really shocking.
Yeah, they're, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the whole scary thing. Every time I've encountered them, I've been surprised at how personable they are, because in all of my work, they are the big evil. Them and feral cats are the big sort of drivers of all of the extinctions that I've ever read about and looked at in my professional work. And yet, you know, they're such kind of shy and self-effacing creatures.
Really?
In real life. Yeah. And it's always surprised me that, especially when I see them in places where they're supposed to be, that they invoke in me this kind of irrational sense of hatred. I have to remind myself when I see them in the UK that they actually belong here.
Yes, yes. They're not a problem so much there, but here. Mm. Hey, do they smell? Do foxes have a smell? Don't we talk about somebody being foxy, meaning they stink?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if that's the association with people. I've always used the term foxy in a very different sense, but yeah.
Ah, yes, people, there is that sense, yes.
Yes, but people that do work with them quite a lot very much are aware of the smell of particularly fox urine. And fox urine is used a lot in kind of predator aversion training and things like that. It is a very distinctive and quite a powerful odor.
And look, they're about as big as a dog, as big as a big dog, but bonier.
Look, in my experience, a little bit smaller. I mean, certainly in my corner of the world, I ran into a fox camping only a couple of months ago in semi-arid Western Australia, and it would have been a little bit smaller than a Kelpie. So they're not big, but they're, you know, cunning as a fox is a very real yes. term. And I think that's how they have such an impact on our native wildlife, because, you know, they will very much sit and plan and prey upon such a wide variety of things.
Let's go back to the sad origin story. So as with rabbits, foxes are introduced in the western districts of Victoria with some sort of notion that it's going to make the landscape more English and we might even go fox hunting. Was that the motive for bringing them?
Certainly. The understanding is that they were introduced to three properties around Werribee and Corio near Geelong by homesick British aristocrats who wanted to go fox hunting. And it was by no means the first attempt. There had been multiple attempts to introduce foxes before they stuck, but always for the single goal of putting on the red jacket and climbing on the horse and chasing foxes around the country.
It's really fascinating that this is the same area where rabbits were released for hunting. And rabbits had come to Australia with the first fleet. They were rabbits for eating, no problem whatever. But wild rabbits from Britain were brought to this district in Victoria and released for hunting, boom, the rabbit plague. And the same with foxes.
Yeah. In fact, of the three big introductions being cats, foxes and rabbits, it seems like cats were the only ones that kind of escaped by accident. We very much deliberately let rabbits and foxes go for human recreation.
Sean, we're going to be coming back to you on the subject of cats. There is an enormous amount of pressure on me at the ABC not to pursue wild, feral, dangerous, nasty cats because there are cat lovers in here. This is just between you and me. There are cat lovers in the ABC. So we're coming back to cats. But the foxes, your modelling shows how extraordinarily quickly they spread.
Yeah, and I guess now that we're getting down to it, it's understanding that that speed of spread that really drove this whole project. Because while I'm now at Curtin University, I began this work when I was still employed at the Environment Institute at the University of Adelaide, as part of a larger project that is ongoing over there. And that focus really is understanding what the drivers were for the decline of native mammals across Australia. And of course, you can't understand how native mammals have declined without understanding how the threatening processes have spread across space and through time. And that's the thing that really surprised us, is we had expected that we would have models showing foxes spreading across the country. And what we hadn't expected was that after time of release, they would colonize the entire southeast corner within 30 years. And although their spread slowed across the arid zone, they still managed to cross the entire continent within 60 years. So,
Sean, how did they do that? Did they hitch a ride on trucks, or was there some way they got across, or do they have truly remarkable capacity for endurance?
No, look, we have a very British understanding of foxes. You know, they live in our kind of popular zeitgeist as, you know, Fantastic Mr. Fox from Roald Dahl and all of those Christmas cards you see of snowy landscapes and red foxes. But actually, in their natal range across Europe, they inhabit a huge diversity of landscapes right into very arid regions of the Middle East. And so the diversity of environments that they encounter in Australia is really no challenge to them whatsoever. Some of the fascinating things that emerged from our work is we modelled their spread by essentially building population demographic models, so births, deaths, and marriages over space and over time. And what we found in the arid zone was that on average, they have quite a low reproductive rate, but with very large rapid spikes. And of course, that matches the natural boom and bust ecosystem.
Oh, so when it rains, we get foxes.
When it rains, you get lots and lots of foxes, and then the juveniles just spread out looking for a new place to den. And that really is the limiting factor, is density of denning sites. So I think probably they would have spread across the arid zone in bursts, but in quite large jumps, because denning sites are much more spread out in arid ecosystems than in more mesic, wetter ecosystems. And they're also much more concentrated in ecosystems and landscapes that we have modified. So once we started opening the landscape to agriculture, you know, foxes just said, "You beauty, we'll go nuts here." And all of our population jumps happened very closely coinciding with agricultural expansion.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Dr. Sean Tomlinson about the spread of foxes in Australia. Sean, is the fact that Tasmania doesn't have foxes the result of a careful understanding not to repeat the mistakes of the mainland, or is it just good fortune?
Look, let's say both. Let's say both. Foxes never got to Tasmania naturally. For reasons I admit I don't understand, in the early part of colonial Australia, they were just never introduced to Tasmania. But there have been subsequent introductions of foxes to Tasmania through good fortune, and I think through the presence of native predators that are not present on the mainland. Foxes don't take very well in Tasmania, and I believe the latest effort to introduce them was by some anonymous collection of people in the early 21st century, and conservation agencies in Tasmania jumped on that very, very quickly, because we do not want foxes in the last holdout of some of our iconic Australian native species.
Sean, how do you get these extraordinary figures? Foxes kill about 300 million native animals every year, 88 million reptiles, 111 million birds, 107 million mammals. How do you get those figures?
The actual predation effort by foxes comes from a lot of hard work, principally from colleagues up in Darwin, at Charles Darwin Uni, who have spent an awful lot of time looking at the contents of fox stomachs, the contents of fox scats, and basically just going through and saying, well, this is how many animals and this is what kind of diversity there were in individual fox stomachs, and then scaling up.
Yep, yep. I'm surprised there's any native animal left alive, what with, you know, we'll get to cats later down the track, as I say, Sean, but those are huge numbers. What are the native species most at danger from foxes? Have foxes actually pressed any to extinction?
There's no question that foxes and cats have presented a huge conservation threat to Australia's native species, and it has led to a really sad situation where Australia has the highest extinction rate of mammals in the world. For example, 35 native mammals have gone extinct since European colonization. As to whether foxes and cats were the only driver or even the primary driver, that really is a difficult question because, as I've already said, fox populations correlate incredibly well with landscape modification, so land use conversion to agriculture, and that obviously destroys native animal habitat. So native animals suffer when we turn woodlands into wheat fields. Native animals probably also suffer because wheat field landscapes have higher densities of foxes, which then prey more heavily on native animals. And we also have changed fire history throughout all of these landscapes right across Australia. So that really is at the nub of what the Environment Institute's ongoing research program is about, is once we understand how foxes have spread across the landscape and how land use was converted from native vegetation into agriculture and how we changed fire and all of these things, then we can really start unraveling which one of these things was the most powerful contributor. And it's not always the same for every species. So some of our preliminary work with numbats strongly suggests differential pressures of cats, foxes, and land use change. But primarily, we really don't know which of these three major drivers causes extinction and endangerment for different species.
Sean, a last question. Is there really any prospect of getting rid of foxes?
Sadly, I suspect no. One of the best things that we can hope to do is knock them down to the lowest densities possible. And certainly there are some fantastic initiatives doing that at scale across Australia. Started actually here in Western Australia by DBCA, I believe, in Operation Foxglove, which then turned into Western Shield.
What's DBCA?
The Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions here in Western Australia, basing for foxes at landscape scales. Now, that does have benefits, but it cannot eradicate foxes. And I think some of the best things that we can do other than that is the establishment of predator exclusion fences at large scales, the way the Australian Wildlife Conservancy has done, where they can eradicate foxes inside those fences.
And cats.
And then either reintroduce native species or to allow native populations to grow back, recover in those fences. And certainly there's very good track record of that in Australia and also over in New Zealand with their mainland island sanctuaries.
But we were talking the other day to some New Zealanders about their mission and their belief that they can get zero invasive species by 2050. But we can't look to anything like that in Australia.
Look, it's a very ambitious program that they've set over in New Zealand. And look, if anyone can do it, it's the Kiwis, because they do have just a phenomenal track record of wildlife conservation over there. But they're also a very small land area. The invasions and the invasive species they have are also smaller and somewhat easier to control. Foxes are difficult to control, and especially at the kinds of scales that we're talking about in Australia.
And they don't have foxes, do they?
I don't believe so, but don't quote me, because I haven't spent a lot of time looking at foxes in New Zealand. I'm pretty sure their main concern is stoats and hedgehogs.
Yep. But look, back to us. Sean, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. I'm looking forward very much to our discussion on cats and the political problems of dealing with cats, because there's no political problems dealing with foxes, are there? Nobody's got pet foxes, have they?
Nobody seems to have much of an issue with controlling foxes. In fact, a lot of the conversations I've been having since the production of this work has been about getting greater buy-in from people to be able to go out and shoot foxes themselves as pest, you know, citizen pest control. But cats is a totally different question.
Totally different question. Totally different story. We'll do it later down the track. Sean, just describe for me exactly what the work is that you're doing and what it's aiming to achieve.
This work particularly was built out of a program spearheaded by Damien Fordham at the University of Adelaide. And his group is continuing to focus on principally the consequences of fox and cat invasion in Australia and what that means for native mammal conservation and recovery, particularly trying to understand places in Australia where foxes have been on the country for the least amount of time and at the lowest densities, precisely for directing conservation money to where it's best likely to have an outcome. And that includes everything from fox control to wild species recovery, rewilding, feral exclusion fences, all of these expensive things that have to be directed very carefully, precisely because they are so expensive. My interest since returning to Western Australia runs very much parallel to that, but I'm developing a strong interest in what this means for Australia's birds, because I firmly believe that bird conservation is potentially even more complex than mammal conservation, but it's driven by all of the same threatening processes. So if we can understand it and apply it to mammals, I believe we can also apply it to birds.
Thanks for giving us some time. I've been talking to Sean Tomlinson, a lecturer in the School of Molecular and Life Sciences at Curtin University. And that's the show. On our next, Simon Winchester, that wonderful writer. After books on The Raj, The Eruption of Krakatoa, The Alice of Alice in Wonderland, and The Origins of the Oxford English Dictionary, has written a history of the wind called Breath of the Gods. It's invisible, it's all around us, and without the wind, he argues, we'd be nothing.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.